Hello, you're listening to Food Conversations, a program about all aspects of food, from planting seeds to eating, with a special emphasis on food sovereignty in the shoe swap. You're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, and I'm your host, Warren Bell. Today, we have a special guest, and I'm very pleased to welcome her, Andrea Gunner. Andrea, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Excellent. Good. Just for our listeners to know, we're doing this interview through Zoom and maintaining all the COVID precautions in the studio that we need to. I'm here with my co-host and producer, Steve Corey.
Good morning.
Good morning. Andrea. Andrea is an agricultural economist and the co-owner of Rosebank Farms, a pastry poultry farm, which has also satellite farms, which Andrea and her husband Steve supervise. Andrea, good morning and welcome properly.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
It's a pleasure to have you here. What I wanted to start with was a little scenario that kind of will help our listeners to understand what you do as an agricultural economist and somebody who advises farmers. Imagine I'm Farmer Jones and I've come to you because I want to start up production of a certain crop. Would I first of all come to you? And second of all, if I did, what would you start to tell me or help me with?
That's a question that I haven't been asked on radio before, Warren, and really fun because I do get that a lot. I get people who phone me where they have an idea and they think that they would like to get into the farming industry. And so the first thing I always do is go and meet with them. Even in these days of COVID protocols, it's very easy to meet a farmer and go for, or a would-be farmer and go for a walk around their property and their see what their outbuildings are like, see what their infrastructure is. So the first thing is always to do a resource assessment.
So it's a direct assessment on their land.
Absolutely. And then we'll have a chat about what they're thinking, what resources they have, what their interests are. And usually within about half an hour, I can tell whether it's something that they actually need to hire me, or I can just give them a bit of a direction. So I usually do those first. I'll have a phone conversation. I'll go out and see what their place is. And then depending on what they want, we'll put together a budget for it and help them along the path of developing a business.
What tells you, Andrea, that they are somebody who can use your services? How do you understand that they will be needing what you have to offer?
It's a matter of seeing if our interests align. So I don't work with conventional industries generally. I work with people who are looking at doing something novel and perhaps a little bit eclectic, because that's where my interests lie. And because niche marketing in the Thompson, Okanagan, we've got some of the highest priced land, especially in the Okanagan, highest priced land in North America. And so to look at a farmer who's looking at starting out with a modest investment, they are going to need to be very, very smart and intentional about
and strategic.
Yes, in how they apply their resources.
Would you say that there's a certain proportion of people who come to you that you end up accepting as clients or taking on as people you want to advise? What sort of percentage would it be, perhaps?
I would say probably about 20 to 25% of people that approach me that I actually take on as clients.
So the others just aren't in the right ballpark for you?
Yes, sometimes it's because they're too small and really can't afford my services. Sometimes it's because what they're doing is just not what they're thinking of doing, just doesn't have the complexity to it that they actually need somebody with my kind of expertise. So it really varies. Yes, but I would say a lot of people will contact me and they are interested in getting some advice, but really it's not complicated enough that they need to pay for my services. I can give them 15 minutes or half an hour of time and just set them on the right course.
A little bit of free advice to guide them in their next steps.
Yes.
Andrea, you didn't just start doing this yesterday. You've been doing working with food and land and growing things for a very long time. In fact, I think you told me that it really is kind of a genetic thing to some degree. It's in your DNA. You started out with a special start. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, so as a child, I was always outside and in the garden, which was to my parents' chagrin because my parents were professional musicians and their ideas how I would spend my time was in the studio practicing. And I would escape every opportunity I got. And often, as soon as I learned to ride a bike, I would ride my bike far from home and head out into the countryside where there were farms. And it wasn't until I was in my early 30s that I found out that there's actually a genetic link to that. And that is that I knew as a child that I was adopted. What I didn't know until I was in my early 30s was that my birth father was a rancher and my birth mother was the daughter of a line of Scottish crofters on both the Isle of Islay, which is one of my favorite, probably my favorite whiskey region, and also Speyside. So, hey, genetics. I like Scotch whiskey and I come from...
It was a guarantee. It was a guarantee. But you parlayed that genetic heritage into some very concrete decisions in your life with respect to what you went to university to learn, because you went to university at UBC and studied agricultural and animal science at the beginning, but then you changed course. What made you change course when you went to university?
I had gone into animal science expecting to be pre-vet, and in first year university, at the time, the university assigned a member of the faculty to each student. And I was not assigned to an animal science prof. I was assigned to a horticulture prof. And as it turned out, I had spent my summers on an extended family's orchard in the Lake Country region. So I was familiar with horticulture and I'd always helped and taken a lead role in the family garden. But the professor that I was assigned to was Dr. George Eaton. He was a professor emeritus. He was in his 70s. He still had, I think, about 13 or 14 grad students under his watch. He was an extraordinary horticultural mentor. And his passion in his 70s was such that I couldn't help but look at horticulture again as a career opportunity. Also thinking about, I wanted to be going into a large animal vet practice, and the demands and the rigors, the physical rigors of that job made me rethink it. And Dr. Eaton's passion, he was a pomologist, which is the study of pollen, so palm fruits, apples, pears, that kind of thing, but really the study of pollen and the intricacies and the fact that this man had spent 50 years and was still as passionate as anything about what was unknown.
He was an amazing grandfather.
Yes.
Agricultural, yes. Grandfather.
Yeah, so I ended up actually doing my thesis for my bachelor's degree in genetic engineering, which was very, very new, very novel at that time.
Why? This was obviously a coincidence or an act of fate that you went into animal science and yet you were assigned a mentor who was deeply embedded in the world of horticulture. Do you have any idea how the universe arranged for that particular coincidence?
I think that in the human condition, that time, I was 17 at the time, that age between sort of 15 to 25 is one of such incredible discovery. There are so many neurological changes that are going on. And so people are very open to new experiences at that stage of life. And I think that it was just one of those things that the universe steps up and
you spoke to the universe and the universe answered.
Yes.
Wonderful. Well, I hope you continue to speak to the universe. It gets you a leg up on lots of different things. In the course of not only your studies, but while you were at university, you also made some side trips to other parts of the world. Tell listeners a little bit about your trip to New Zealand.
Yeah, so after the end of second year, I had met my roommate in first year university, turned out to be a very good friend. She was the maid of honor at my wedding as I was at hers. She now lives in Salmon Arm. I live in Armstrong. We, of course, were both going to school in Vancouver at the time. She had a desire. Her father had gone to Australia when he was a young man, and she had been raised on the stories of Australia and New Zealand and wanted very badly to go. So she basically talked me into
going to New Zealand.
I make the trip, and she was not. She's a physiotherapist, and she was not. She was told that if she took a year out, that she would have to redo her previous years of university in order to catch up. So I went with another friend, and we went to New Zealand first. And while we were there, of course, leaving.
She's breaking. We're having a little sound problem here, so we missed some of that. You're heading off to New Zealand.
So we're heading off to New Zealand. We head off in the fall in October, and of course it's spring in New Zealand. We traveled for some time, and then in staying with a family on a farm that was a link from a friend at UBC. We worked for them. It was shearing season.
And you saw some technical advancement that you were really quite surprised by. You saw some unusually advanced way of doing things.
What I saw, because we ended up working on several sheep stations because of shearing season, but then staying on to work just to help out with moving flocks from one range to another. Hmm. New Zealand is a part of the world that's very volcanic. They have very thin soils. And what I saw there was an incredible system
. Yeah, our sound has dropped out, listeners, but we're working on that. This is the vagaries of digital communication. Andrea, how are you doing? Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Excellent. Can you hear me? Very good. Well, in addition to taking your courses, you not only went to New Zealand and saw some fairly advanced land management approaches, which I remember you telling me surprised you compared to what you had seen here in Canada.
Yes, the reason that it surprised me is because it was so simple and yet so effective, and the fact that it was not being done in any of our rangelands, that animals were being free to wander wherever they wanted, and as such there was a fair bit of overgrazing, and there still is, but that is changing. Regenerative agriculture has caught on. It was just frustrating for me that in the mid-1980s there was this wonderfully simple and very effective technique. New Zealand, if you think about it, it looks like crushed velvet if you've seen the movies The Hobbit or any of the Lord of the Rings series. And I recognize that that was a technique that was very, very replicable.
Indeed. You also did a couple of other things. One was that you worked part-time for the Ministry of Agriculture. And another was that you went to Europe, and you saw things in Europe that also stirred your imagination and creativity. Tell listeners about that.
So in Europe, I went over on a horticulture tour. So we had the opportunity to go to Holland, Denmark, and Germany. And it was a 2-week tour, and it was set up by one of the, at Malaspina College, they had a horticulture program at the time. And so it was really to show people both within the ministry and within industry what was going on in leading edge horticulture. And so I remember at the time going into a greenhouse, about a 14-acre greenhouse in Denmark. And this was in the early 1990s, where they had 5 employees. 3 of them were doing the cuttings and the seeding. And then 2 people were loading trucks. And the robots basically took care of everything else.
That's less than, that's one worker for every three or four acres. That's astonishing.
Yes. Yeah, it was. And this was in 1990.
And you'd never seen anything like that in this part of the world.
No, not at all. No, I had been doing economic analysis in the greenhouse industry in both the floriculture and the food side of it. I had worked in the greenhouse industry and the nursery industry at that point. And no, there was nothing like that at the time in Canada.
So when you saw the contrast between what was going on in other countries and what was going on in BC, how did that stir your blood? It must have struck you as rather compelling.
It was very compelling, and I know it's unfortunate that BC still funds its agricultural industry at a lower level than any other province in Canada. That has been the case for all of my career, so some 35 years. And unfortunately, Canada funds its agriculture industry, puts resources back into it that's the lowest of the OECD countries.
So we're the lowest of the low.
Yes, it's remarkable what farmers in BC are able to do, especially considering that we have some of the most expensive agricultural land in North America.
And often very challenging terrain as well in many parts of the province.
Yes, yeah. We know that ourselves, farming on the top of a hill that is clearly glacial till and not much else.
Okay, let's talk about that for a moment, Andrea. That was a moment, a turning point in your life when the snow melted on the land you had purchased and you saw what you actually owned. Tell our listeners about that wake-up call.
Yeah, well, it was a horror show. It was our first time buying a piece of acreage. We had been living in Abbotsford and we had moved to the Okanagan. And the plan had been to go back to New Zealand for me to do my master's in economics there. And things went sideways. I don't need to go into why they went sideways, but we decided that we would settle in the Okanagan, somewhere between the north and central Okanagan. And at the time, property values were going crazy. We had sold our house in Abbotsford, so we had some equity to put onto a piece of acreage. And we were at the point where I think when we bought the place we're on, it was our 7th or 8th offer that we had made on a piece of land within
really?
About
so you'd 2 months. You'd been looking hard and at lots of different places.
Yes.
Very challenging time.
At some points, we had deposits placed on 2 different properties at the same time. Like, it really was pretty
crazy. That's pretty
crazy.
Pretty scary. Yeah.
So we drove to this one. We basically drove the driveway, saw that there was a house with a roof on it, that there was an acreage. It was in our snack bracket in terms of budget. And so we put an offer on it. I don't remember actually walking through the house. And when we took possession, it was the beginning of June, and we arrived with all of our gear and our 2 very small children and looked at what we bought, which was as tall as I am in weeds, and I'm over 5'10". So it was something of a shock.
And the quality of the soil itself and the land, the surface, what was that like?
Well, what had attracted us to the property when we bought it was that it wasn't flat land. It had some context, some contour, and so we thought that was interesting and going to be going to be, if it didn't turn out and we did end up going to New Zealand as a small acreage, we would be able to sell it again. So that was our sort of vision at the time. What the heck, we'll try this one. Of course, when the weeds were that tall, you can't really do anything with it. And in June, you cannot contract a farmer to come and cut your weeds. Because of course they're haying, it's forage season. And so there aren't anybody available. There isn't anybody available to do that kind of work. So it took us until the beginning of August to get a tractor and a brush beater. And of course, by that time, all the weeds had gone to seed.
So what was that experience like, being surrounded by seed-bearing weeds, not being able to get in? It must have been a terrible time for you.
Well, it was actually worse than that, because the
worse than terrible.
Worse than terrible, because the property next door had been clear-cut at the same time, so we knew that something was up. They didn't have the weed situation. But what he was doing was disking and tilling the land. And so he was taking whatever weeds he had there. And of course, it was summertime. So June and July was a fairly dry June. He was blowing all his soil over to our place where it was getting caught in the weeds. And it was just a dust bowl. It was just terrible.
Does Does every farmer have a story up their sleeve like this of being right next to annihilation and somehow pulling back? This sounds like you must have really been sitting in your kitchen staring at the wall, wondering what was coming next.
Farmers are resilient and eternally optimistic.
A good thing to be under the circumstances.
Yes. So when we actually managed to cut down all the weeds and clear away the mess, then we saw what we had, which was glacial till. So we had very little soil. We had mostly rocks and lichen. And then we had burdock and Canada thistle. So the first thing that we did is we
wept.
Made a plan.
You wept.
No, we made a plan.
Good for you.
And luckily, I had that New Zealand experience to know that we could do something using animals. What I know now, of course, is biological diversity is the absolute key to everything. At the time, we didn't know that, but we did know that pigs, when you grow them on a pasture basis, are really good at turning up rocks and digging out roots. So we got pigs.
They're looking for truffles, and what they're finding is rocks. My goodness. How did you guys feel? I mean, I know you buckled down and you made good, as they say. But at that time, it must have seemed like a pretty dark moment in your lives.
Well, we had not intended that we were going to get full family income off the farm in that first year. We knew that it was going to take a bit of time. My husband was looking after the children. He was a house husband for the first 7 years of having children. And I was the one that was still working on contract for the government and doing economic research. And so it was really, really lucky for me, because I did, I think over the course of the 20 years that I did contract work, there was a program that they had called Planning for Profit. And I was their lead contractor. And I think I did personally myself something like 167 commodities throughout British Columbia, of both livestock and horticultural enterprises, a lot of niche market. I did the agroforestry series. So I was aware of and doing research into all the different ways that we could go.
So looking at these 167 different food commodities, that gave you a broad vision, did it not? That you could see the whole picture, in addition to the picture, of course, that you saw in your own land, but you also could relate that to all sorts of other people's experiences and different ways of managing things, that kind of thing.
Not only that, but I could also see where there were economic possibilities as compared to things that were really long range that we probably didn't have the resources for. So just back to the beginning of our conversation, where when I go out and talk to people and look at the piece of land, the resources that they have and what their plan is that's the same process that we went through, is what do we have? How can we make this work? And then do we have the resilience? Do we have the stubbornness and persistence to pull it off?
Well, clearly you did, because Rosebank Farms is doing very well now. It was part of your work with the ministry that led you to meeting your future husband, Steve. Tell us a little bit about that. You were working as a consultant, I believe, a horticultural teacher.
Yes, I wasn't actually working for the ministry at that point. I had been working for the ministry on contract, but I was actually living in the research greenhouses at UBC when I got a call from the Langley School District asking me if I would be interested in teaching a career development program.
Andrew, just for a moment, what was it like living in a greenhouse? That's not where everybody lives, as far as I'm aware.
No, it was UBC's research greenhouse, which had a caretaker suite in it. So I wasn't, you know, I had curtains.
You weren't sleeping among the plants.
No, but when I opened my door and walked out, I walked out directly into the botanical research greenhouse that had fresh figs and bananas and papaya and all kinds of flowers. Didn't have any monkeys, but other than that, it was really like walking into a Central American jungle.
I want you to know that when you said that you walked out into this rainforest equivalent, Steve had his arms in the air and was rejoicing at the idea, the image of you doing that. So in that greenhouse, you were also working, right?
Yes, I was also doing the genetic engineering research for my thesis. And I was also working as a caretaker and running the Environment Canada Research Climatological Station on UBC campus.
And just for listeners to know, when you say genetic engineering, this was not the high-tech version that Monsanto does, but more plant breeding, quite advanced and sophisticated plant breeding insertion.
It was a precursor to that, where I was intentionally mutating genes and then putting C4 genes into other plants. So I used bean, Phaseolus vulgaris, for doing that. But yeah, I was gamma irradiating my little plants, and then
seeing what happened to them when you gave them an extra treatment.
Yes, choosing from the mutations.
So when you weren't living in the greenhouse, you were doing this horticulture program in Langley, I understand.
Yes. So I was hired by the Langley School District to run this two-year grade 11 and grade 12 career preparation program. And I had a board of 14 industry stakeholders from the greenhouse and horticulture industry, intensive horticulture industry. And one of those was a mushroom farm. And that's where I met my husband, was when I was taking students on a field trip of the mushroom farm. And Steve, the mushroom farmer, he had been in the mushroom industry at that point for about 15 years. He'd had his own farm, and now he was managing one of three big farms. And he saw me with my group of students, and he was the general manager of the farm, and he said to his production manager, and he still claims that the words came out of his mouth without him knowing. So the first time he saw me, he said, "I'm going to marry her one day."
Well, I'll be darned. Another one of those magical moments, not necessarily to do with agriculture, but to do with human relationships. So that's wonderful.
The interesting background, of course, is that the mushroom industry has also changed quite a bit. And he was involved in the Fraser Valley Mushroom Growers. He was part of the committee structure in it. And of course, learned a lot about international marketing from that. So our skills coincide and support each other.
And he also had, obviously, a great deal of practical experience being an actual farmer doing things on the land for 15 years.
Yes, and he was from his parents had run the broiler breeder operation for Otter Co-op, and they also had a nursery a native plant nursery in Langley. So yeah, he was well embedded in the agriculture industry, much more so than I was from a practical viewpoint.
That must have led early on in the relationship to some in-depth conversations about food and land and growing things and having a farm. It seems like it was a very much a match made in another part of the universe, which we could call heaven, or we could certainly call a pretty good place anyway.
From my background of being concerned that the farming industry actually was economically viable, very interesting to look at his side of things with sort of the larger scale and the small margins, the large capital invested and the small margin return. So yes, we've had many years of interesting conversations about the food system.
And the food system, which in this part of the world is often poorly understood by consumers, and indeed that small margin that farmers have to deal with on a daily basis is not always fully appreciated as well.
No. And I think if we think about, there was another time in my experience working for the Ministry of Agriculture when that really shifted.
You were working for the marketing arm, I believe.
Yes. There was a marketing branch in the until the mid 80s. And I was working for them in 84 and 85. Or 85 and 86, regardless. There was a shift. So the first year that I worked for them, I was a summer student. I had come back from New Zealand, so I'd had the experience there of seeing the international marketing and the scale of production and their technologies that they were using. And I came back and got the job with a marketing branch. And my job the first year was to go around to, I spent one whole day a week visiting retail produce outlets throughout the Lower Mainland and Greater Vancouver. And then I would spend Thursday and Friday. I'd do that on Wednesday. On Thursday and Friday, I would do all the analysis of it and report back to the individual stores, the various commodities, what the prices were coming in from the US and what their competitors were doing and where they stacked up. I wouldn't tell them their competitors up directly, but as the range, here is where you are in the range of the market.
So you were trying to help them run their businesses more efficiently.
That's right.
Yeah.
The following year, so that would take up 3 days of my week, and then the other 2 days I was doing research.
And how many retail entities were there that you were dealing with, like 10, 20, 30, 50, whatever?
Yeah, I spent the day going to about 14 or 15.
Okay.
So driving through out from Surrey all the way through Metro Vancouver. So traffic wasn't what it is now.
You were on the road a lot though, weren't you? Yeah.
Yes, I was. Anyway, that changed the next year because the Overweighty Food Group had decided that it was more efficient if they had one person do the buying for all the stores in Western Canada.
All the Overweighty stores.
All the Overweighty stores. So that included Save-On Foods, that included, their whole chain, which at the time was significant. They were certainly the grocery leader, and they had moved into Alberta at that point and were moving into Saskatchewan. So it went from spending the day visiting all these different stores to phoning Fred. He was the head produce buyer for the Overweighty Food Group. Mm-hmm. I would phone Fred first thing in the morning, and then I would go to maybe three or four of the stores that were small independents. But really, the Overweighty Food Group basically took over and shifted how produce was done. Before that time, individual stores had an individual produce buyer, and the small chains like IGA is Independent Grocers Association. So those stores are owned and they still do that. Askew's Food still has a produce buyer, although the produce buyer is in each store. They collaborate and certainly communicate with each other. And so they have, you know, it's a neat thing about our local food system, because the Askew's Foods in their four different stores still buy locally from local growers that they have relationships with from year to year. That is not the case in the rest of the food industry.
And that's definitely not what Overweighty was aiming to do at that point, and then subsequently did.
They certainly did not want to have those individual store buyers. They were really fine-tuning their labor efficiency.
I mean, saving money.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they, you said, amalgamated all of their stores into one single purchasing megalith. I mean, it was a big operation at that point.
Right. So they had, I can't remember how many thousand square feet of warehouse space as well, because they were also running a wholesale arm. And so Fred was buying everything for everyone. So now, unless you could deliver on the order of, you know, 5 to 7 to 20 truckloads of a commodity at one shot on a weekly basis, you couldn't talk to them anymore.
My Lord, that must have had an incredible effect on small producers and small retailers.
It really did. It had a huge impact. And of course, when you look at the grocery industry, the grocery retailers really dictate to consumers what they buy and how much they pay for it and where they buy it. So there's a tremendous amount of control. And honestly, Overweighty was just following the path that had already been set in the U.S.
Yes, indeed. And is, in fact, set around the world with very long supply lines, movement of food and other commodities over thousands of kilometers, because there are large now companies that just do the sorting, the distribution. They are not directly affiliated with the retailers. They supply the retailers. It's a massive system now.
Yes. Yeah. And the grower is at the end of it getting pennies per item that a consumer in the retail store is paying dollars for.
We're going to, Andrea, we talked before we went on air about doing a second show, and I think that's a really good thing for us to do, because laying out the scenario as it now is and possibilities for the future, I think, is an important part of this discussion. Where do we go from here? We've got to the point now where Overweighty has vacuumed up the entire retail sector for produce, and there are people saying we don't want that necessarily be the way things work. And early on, you said diversity is a major factor in conditioning resilience. If you have diversity, biodiversity, but also economic diversity and social diversity, then you get systems that work well. I think when the word you used to me a few days ago when you were talking about this was that the Ministry of Agriculture and its marketing arm essentially imploded. It just vanished sort of off the face of the earth. Is that what it was like?
Yeah. The director of the marketing branch took early retirement, very early retirement, and the other marketing branch personnel went into industry. There was not that support for them. And at the time, Treasury, the situation in the province was such that Treasury Board went to the Minister of Agriculture and said, you know, we're going to have to slash your budget, so you get to choose what goes. And the minister, who has told me personally he deeply regrets it as the worst mistake he ever made in his life, chose to lose Extension. And
Farm Extension.
Yeah. So the people in the industry who help farmers be better farmers, to bring them the new research, the new techniques, organize the field visits. And so that disappeared. And of course, it's been a challenge for the industry ever since. Not that it wasn't challenging before, but it makes it that much worse. So luckily, there are other organizations that have come forward in recent years, like in the last 3, 4, 5 years. And some of that is supported by government grants. Some of it is supported by private individuals and small business.
You mentioned about the extension program. And I remember as a child, the extension program. I wasn't involved directly with farming, but I remember that there were advisors who went around the province and helped individual farmers or landowners do things better. Tell us a little bit about that program and then what happened to it.
So you're right. It was people who had a practical background who were charged with an area. They still have, the Ministry of Agriculture still has specialists, but they are more involved in implementing programs rather than leading on farm research trials, for instance. So when I was, I think between high school and university, I worked running research trials for the local ministry. As a summer student, there were those trials all over the place, as well as at the research station, the Agriculture Canada Research Station. So a lot of that extension work was taken into industry on a regular basis. The format and the infrastructure of the industry was a little bit different in terms of, we had a Federation of Agriculture, which was more broad-based rather than now it's more siloed. And so there was a lot of cross-pollination, if you will, of ideas and technology and results.
These little plant metaphors have a way of stealing their way into the conversation, don't they?
Yeah, I can't help it. I tend to be a bit of a punner.
Well, when we're punning about food, this is the place to do it, Andrea, on food conversations.
Anyway, that was the thing that, when the Minister of Agriculture at the time was forced to choose between what could be let go, extension was thought to be replaced by the commodity associations themselves that could still do that. And to some extent they do, but what we lost, we really lost that cross-pollination. And it's interesting, coming from a horticulture background, how much I've learnt about plant-soil interactions from people in animal science who are ranchers or who are forage growers. And that kind of thing happened before, but it really doesn't happen now unless you happen to be somebody in my situation of doing a lot of research and extension in my own business.
Your background, Andrea, initially was in horticulture, but also a strong element of studying economics and the vitality of the food production systems we have in terms of them allowing people to work and have a living wage. The connection between the economy and food is obviously a close one, and you said earlier that in this province, farmers are least supported compared to other parts of the country, and Canada puts fewer dollars into the food production systems than most other countries in, say, the OECD. What kind of impact has that had on this relationship between economics and growing food?
Oh, the big thing is that it has really eliminated the medium scale production units. So we've got very, very small production units, and we have very, very big production units. And the days of having a mixed family farm that would supply extended family with jobs has become very, very hard in this province. So there are, of course, supply management farms that are quite big, that are farming multiple animal units on multiple pieces of land, not just their home farms, but often leased or purchased elsewhere. And then there are the very small market gardeners who are farming very intensively on, in some cases, like in Kelowna, Curtis Stone, who does his spin farming on, I think the last time I talked to Curtis, he was growing on 6 different locations, which is all within the city center of Kelowna, basically using people's backyards and front yards.
And what do they grow in these small these are viable farms that, that can earn an income. They must be growing some very high value crops, like what, garlic or you know, things that you can sell and make a good turn economically with.
In that case, the new one, and you'll see this if you go into an Ask You store, there's a local farm out in Lumbee that does sprouts. So sprouts is one because it's got a very short time cycle. So you're using your infrastructure, but multiple times, which is the same way that the chicken growers in the quota system supply management do. They're running those chickens through. They're using the same barn, but they're running multiple crops of chickens through in a year, as compared to, say, in the 1950s or 1960s.
12 to 14 weeks, something like that.
Yeah, they were more like about 15 to 16 weeks in the 50s and 60s, and now they're down to 32 to 35-day cycles.
My Lord.
So the people who are farming on very small pieces are doing high-value multiple plantings. So even in a market garden, they'll pull a crop out when it's at the end and reseed it, have it back in production very quickly within the week. And that's the way, because of our relatively short growing season compared to the lower mainland, that is the way that a grower here can do it, by having a very, very clear, concise operations plan and be putting those crops in with very little time running fallow between them.
Now, just for listeners who are aware of the shorter growing season in this part of the province, you actually grew food in the far north of this part of the world. Tell listeners about your experience as a gardener in, I think, the Yukon.
In the Yukon. I spent a summer as a cook in a mining camp, in an exploration camp, 300 miles northwest of Mayo, which is about a two-hour flight from Whitehorse, so up just south of the Arctic Circle. And the lovely thing about growing in that climate is that the daylight, there is so much daylight, it really never gets dark in the summertime. I was up there June, July, and August, came down at the beginning of September. And I could literally stand in the garden and watch the peas grow.
Well, that's almost as good as eating them. And it's quite dramatic, I'm sure.
Yes, it was a fabulous eye-opener. And with the new LED lighting technology, growers are bringing that into. So that's how the sprout business works. These wonderful 4-foot, 8-foot LED daylight spectrum lights that have really come down in price. Their light efficiency is excellent, and their cost is much better. Their running cost is negligible. That has allowed growers with a very small space to have an economically viable business.
And there's a durability to LEDs as well. They last longer. The typical filament bulbs don't last that long, or even fluorescents.
Yeah, no, they're great. The days of the high-pressure sodium are long past, thank goodness.
When I was at university, I found out that, in fact, at one point, the Yukon used to supply vegetables to southern BC during the summer, because if it's extremely long, they would have two full crop cycles in one summer. And you obviously proved in practical terms that that is very easy to do when you know what you're doing.
Yeah, it was actually pretty fabulous, because I never knew how many people were coming for dinner. It could be anywhere between the 7 or 8 on the exploration crew up to an additional 50 miners. And so having a garden there that I could go and just grab more produce and make many more bowls of salad along with the other foodstuffs, having fresh produce was great, because everything else we got, of course, came flown in from southern Canada one day a week.
Yeah, it's interesting how growing food in what would be normally considered inhospitable climates, using things like greenhouses and minimal heating systems. There's an experimental program in Quebec right now to grow in greenhouses with temperatures between 2 and 5 degrees Celsius. And of course, they're growing crops like lettuce and others, some root crops are very tolerant of the cold, but they're doing it in the middle of winter. And that's taking the season that you have in the summer and putting a little artificial lighting in and a very minimal amount of heating and giving four seasons of food production. We're getting on towards the end of the show, but I want to just lay out one statement that I came across recently and just get you to comment on it. It's from a document called BC's Farming and Food Future. It was written in 2009 for Farm Folk, City Folk by an agronomist with the Land Conservancy of BC, Wanda Gorsuch. I don't know if you know her. And here's part of what she said in the introduction. The full value of food production to community health and well-being is often not recognized or taken into account in decision-making. Incorporating food systems thinking into local government policy, planning, and programs can be challenging because the food system touches on so many sectors, including land, water, transportation, housing, business, and health. What she's laying out is a picture of food production and its presence in all aspects of our lives in many, many areas. You've been able to see that yourself because of all the work you've done around the province, seeing other farmers, seeing multiple commodity sectors, etc. Resilience and diversity, which is what we started with in your initial comments, that do you see that it's increasing, that there's more diversity, more resilience, and that all these different systems are starting to become more food friendly, food production friendly? Do you see any trends in that direction?
What gives me hope is the move to regenerative agriculture, to building soil diversity and biological diversity in the system. What also gives me hope is the number of new entrants into the farm population that are from non-farming backgrounds, that something is drawing them into a food production space, and they come from a variety of backgrounds and bring those skills and perspectives from it, which I think is of immense importance if we're going to go forward and make positive change. The other thing that's happened is that our current Minister of Agriculture has been doing this for a long time, has been the critic in opposition before this current government.
Talking about Lana Popham?
Yes. Yeah. And is instructing staff to put time, energy, resources into the Feed BC program.
We're going to have to call it a day, Andrea, but I would like to tell our listeners that we're going to have you back for another show. And the reason is that we're ending on a note of hope, but we need to flesh out that hope into some concrete parameters so that people can understand why that hope exists. So I'm delighted to have you here. Thank you very much for your time today.